This week's episode of Bazong is brought to you by AdamandEve.com, where almost every item in store can be gotten for 50% off, and then you're going to put in the promotional code at checkout, Bazong! That's Bazong at checkout to load up on free gifts. I'm talking about a free gift for him, another free gift for her, and a third free gift for your grandma. So load up that cart today. I just found out about the womanizer, the adult toy that's taking the world by storm. It's changing everything. Put that womanizer in your cart, get a 50% off. Put in that promotional code Bazong. You'll get 50% off. You'll get a free gift for him, free gift for her, free gift for grandma, free shipping on it all, and 6 free tantalizing spicy movies. All of that for you from Bazong and the Project Entertainment Network. AdamandEve.com.
The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Bazong.
Bazong.
Bazong. Bazong. Bazong.
Bazong. Bazong. Bazong. Bazong. Bazong.
This is Bazong, the weird and wacky fiction podcast, with me, your host, Mr. Frank. Zongers, this week's episode of Bazong is brought to you by the new book from Chandler Morrison, Until the Sun. This is not your grandma's vampire novel. Responsibility, authority, morality. If you could liberate yourself of these burdens, would any cost be too great? On a hot August night, a troubled 15-year-old boy with a tragic past wakes up to find his tyrannical foster parents murdered by a trio of nocturnal, blood-drinking heathens. The killers give him the opportunity for a new life, one where he can be relieved of traditional hardships, vanquish his enemies, and attain a sense of true belonging at the cost of what little remains of his humanity. The life he is offered is one of eternal darkness, but the promise of undying acceptance, freedom, and power gives it an appeal that his current dreaded existence is lacking. Fraught with resentment over his catastrophic adolescence and confronted by ambiguous notions of good and evil, he is forced to explore a dark world on the fringe between bliss and oblivion. As he edges ever closer to a climactic encounter with the demons that plague his soul, he discovers just how dangerous it is to be young and alienated in modern society. Available in Kindle and paperback on Amazon on the holiest of days, Halloween, from Death's Head Press. That's Until the Sun, new from Chandler Morrison, this Halloween. And Until the Sun is available right now on Amazon for pre-order, so you don't gotta wait to get your copy, except that you gotta wait until Halloween, but it'll be there waiting for you if you pre-order it now. You know what? There's another thing you don't have to wait for, Zongers. That's this week's new Bazong interview. It's a guest I've been dying to get on the show for the longest time, not only for my own personal reasons, but because so many of you have reached out to me privately or when I've put out calls for, like, who would you want to hear on Bazong? And this week's guest was consistently requested on the show. Like I say in the interview, I don't keep official records of who's requested and how often they're requested. But I think behind Carlton Mellick, this guest is probably the second most requested. And finally, he's ready to come on Bazong and share his story. We have a great interview. I think this is normally the guests are the ones that are they're nervous. I'm not sure. I haven't done podcasts and everything. And I try to assure them, no problem. Cool as a cucumber. We're just going to have a nice little discussion. You're going to just forget that we're having a conversation to be recorded for a podcast. And often it works out that way. But I think this interview, I was actually a little nervous myself because this week's guest, Anderson Prunty, is a big deal in bizarre and weird fiction circles because he's sort of a vanguard. He was there toward the beginning, not the very beginning, but like he was right there in the thick of it as Bizarro was becoming this thing. And we touch on some of that stuff. So, and Anderson's work stands the test of time. You can go back anywhere in his catalog, pick up any of it. It's all really good, intense, weird fiction, and bizarro, if you'd like to call it that at times. He's all over the place. A really awesome dude, a really great writer, and I'm finally happy to be able to present you, Zongers, with the Bazong interview of the one and only Anderson Parenti. Give us the gong. I am so happy to have on Bazong this week a guest who is, I would have to say, I don't keep official records of this, but I would have to say he's probably the second most requested guest to have on the show. Finally here, once and for all, on Bazong, welcome to Bazong, the one, the only, Mr. Anderson Parenti. Anderson, welcome to Bazong.
Hello.
A pleasure to have you on here. And like I said, a lot of people have been asking for you, and I've had to tell them for the last couple of years, like, you know, I have invited you on the show. You just politely declined. Not your thing. But now you're ready to be a part of the show and reveal your truth.
Yeah. You won me over, Frank.
Glad to do so. Now you're at least at the minimum a double threat, because not only do you write and write extremely fun stuff to read, but you're also you're the head editor of Addle Press.
Exactly. Yep.
Which came first for you?
Writing definitely came first. My first book was published through Eraserhead. So I actually ended up doing 5 books with them and 1 book with Lazy Fascist. And then I think I had probably 2-3 books out with them, and then I started Oddle first and Grindhouse second, and they were more or less just to I think I had submitted stuff for years. There were definitely some things that I had lying around that were not right for Eraserhead. I had a couple of things that happened that I think kind of burned me on a lot of some of the other small presses in horror, and there really weren't many in Bizarro at the time. I had books, and my friends had books, and I wanted to see, how it would go. I had a graphic designer friend who was all on board. So he did the logos and was set to do the covers. And, yeah, I just basically published The Beard on Oddle, which was just a funny, goofy novel that I wrote for NaNoWriMo, and wasn't doing anything with it. And it was more or less just published as an experiment to see, to see what would happen, if anything. And it did okay. And then I did the same thing with Grindhouse. Again, just ran one of my own books, Morning is Dead, through the mill, just to get a feel for the experience of publishing. And it's that way, at least I was the one taking the hit if it right. didn't turn out well at all. And that was, I think, Oddle was 2009 and Grindhouse was 2010.
Very interesting. So both started just for a way to for you to like self-publish your stuff that you didn't really think would fit in easily elsewhere. And now,
although the goal was to ultimately not be publishing my own stuff, like I said at the time, I had a relationship with Eraserhead, so for that kind of stuff, that's where I was intending to go with that. And then continued to, send more of the more ambitious books to agents and things like that with, zero success whatsoever.
So really you were just kind of using you were guinea pigging your own work to start these presses and imprints.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, sorry. And the, you know, like I said, the goal was always to end up publishing other people, because, you know, at the same time too, I had friends who were, you know, writing stuff that was, you know, if they had relationships with other small presses, you know, it was being rejected from them just for, you know, content or you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, just basically you can't, I'm sure some people would argue this, but, you know, it's good to have a number of small presses around just for, you know, variety, and so that good books can find good homes.
Yeah, and Addle and Grindhouse, for that matter, have served that purpose very well. Two distinct sort of presses that put out two distinct type of books. But you've always been able to put out really, really good books. Like, there, it's not anything. Is it, have those books come to you as a result of sort of how you branded them, or did you have to really seek out what it was you were looking for initially, and now it's sort of working where those stories come to you?
Well, thanks. No, but we, no, I mean, I think the first thing that I did through Grindhouse was a Gina Rinaldi book, House of Fallen Trees, which was originally published as like a limited edition through a defunct press called Cargo Cult. You know, so they were like the high end hardcover, you know, books that were unattainable price wise for a lot of people like me. So I took, so to give a trade paperback treatment to something like that, and, you know, digital version. And so again, you know, she was a friend, and it was something that I had solicited from her. And so that's the way, you know, probably half of it has come to me. And then I have opened to submissions and, you know, accepted a few things through that. Things like Mastodon Farm by Mike Klein, which is a really entertaining book. The Death Metal Epic series by Dean Swinford. Those were, again, open submissions. And then, you know, and then there are just writers that I was fans of, like Justin Krimble, and you know, who you know, I just asked him to send me something, and like William Pauly III on Grindhouse, you know, and asked him to send me something, and that's so it's been, you know, it's been a mix. I, you know, I don't really have any set policy. It's just, you know, it's, I'm communicating with people on a day-to-day basis, and, you know, if it's someone that I, you know, like their writing and they have something they want to send to me, then I will tell them to go ahead and send it to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, open up the submissions periodically. And, you know, yeah, look for the best things that come in through that. So yeah, I mean, it's a number of different channels. Nothing.
Right. Yeah. Just
nothing set in stone.
What was out there. Now, I mean, obviously Grindhouse, you're gearing it towards sort of basically horror, darker horror, extreme horror. But Addle is something a little more fuzzy as to what exactly is. How do you describe what Addle is doing specifically?
Right. Well, and also Grindhouse, I'm no longer, you know, right. C.V. Hunt, Carrie does that. So yeah, I'm not doing anything with that other than copy editing the books now. But yeah, Addle, I mean, you know, it sounds pretentious to say to say that we're looking for literary fiction, but yeah, it is a more it definitely has a broader scope of you know, of things that we will accept, and, you know, just generally kind of non-genre things. You know, I think with Addle, I've always paid a lot more attention to the style and yeah, just the writing style and the general writing, rather than you know, anything too thematic.
Right.
And you know, yeah, and I mean, it's, you know, depending on how it's written and how entertaining I find it, it's, the subject matter could be all over the place. I mean, we have you know, coming of age, the coming of age novel of that guy who's touring Europe in a death metal band. Mm-hmm. That's death metal epic. You know, there's the sort of, you know, sort of, I don't know, gross domestic comedies of like someone like Justin Grimble. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, a little bit more surreal what the fuckery of someone like Mike Klein, you know. You know, it's generally all over the place.
I enjoy that the fuzziness of what it really all is. And when I look over what I've read from Adel, is the thing I notice for me more than anything is that it the books are all, no matter what they are, strongly character driven in one way or another, and they're deep sort of examinations of the characters that you might not necessarily find of other presses or books. So that to me is a thing I think I come to know about what Adel is it's a very character driven press for lack of a better word.
Yeah, I've never really thought of that, but I guess a lot of them are.
fair enough. And the other thing too, I guess, is obviously it's recognized as at the very least a bizarro adjacent type press, even though I don't think you would necessarily describe everything, or maybe not anything in the line, as bizarro necessarily, correct?
I think you know, people have probably different ideas of what that means too. Like, I mean, we are, and I think we're probably moving a little away from that too. I mean, that's not something that I've ever really sought out.
Right.
I mean, and you know, again, it's like, if we're not paying to genre, not paying attention to genre. So it's like, if the book is good, that's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, I think there are differences in what people see that as too, which, you know, can all fly under that banner. But I think we tend to do definitely a lot less of the sort of world building, almost fantastical, narratives of, you know, someplace like Eraserhead or, you know, that type of thing.
Right.
But yeah, there's definitely surreal elements to a lot of it. And, you know, I will never not like weird.
Yeah. It's at least a sort of thread that kind of finds its way through almost everything in the line in some way or another.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's like, I had, you know, 5 books with Eraserhead and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was like, even starting, you know, a press, I knew that it was, that a lot of it was going to be seen in that light, which is, you know, that's fine.
Now let's go back with your work in particular and those early publications with Eraserhead. Did you feel at the time that your work was bizarro, or was it just Eraserhead was the press where your work most closely fit?
Well, I mean, I think most of the stuff that I had published with Eraserhead, I don't know that they even used the term bizarro when that was written.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, my first book out through them was The Overwhelming Urge, and that was, you know, just a collection of surreal, you know, hopefully humorous flash fictions. Yeah, with them, it was that they had a, you know, sort of almost like an interview process in lieu of a query process at the time.
Right.
So I filled that out and they contacted me, and it was essentially, they said they were putting together a second Bizarro starter kit, which was the blue one, and wanted to know if I could write a story for that, and they liked it, they would include it in the anthology and sign me up to a 5-book contract. So I did that. I wrote a story called The Devastated Insides of Hollow City, and that's what made it into there. Yeah, signed the 5-book contract, and then and then the second book was, I think, Jack and Mr. Grin, which had already been written. The third one was Zero Strata, which had already been written. And so the books that they did, I think the only thing that was written specifically for them was My Fake War. I mean, everything else just kind of existed within that. So it's nothing that was specifically, you know.
Right.
I don't know that anybody, you know, should really do that anyway. When you're sitting down to write something, write what's inside you. Don't say like I'm going to write a horror novel.
Yeah.
I'm going to write a bizarro novel. I know there are a lot of people that look at it with some sort of marketing goal in mind, but and given my lack of success, obviously the marketing goal was not at the forefront of my brain. So maybe that's really bad advice.
Yeah. Well, it works for you. You know, you got to do what works for you. And I think you're the type of person where if you just wouldn't be, it just wouldn't be true to your art, really, essentially, if you were trying to write to a market necessarily.
Right. Yeah. And like that too, that's, again, it's not even a market that I was familiar with or had grown up around. It's just that, you know, a lot of my stuff had kind of been accepted in those places. Like, D. Harlan Wilson was doing something, an online scene called The Dream People at the time. He liked my stuff, so I had a few things in there. And that was, I think it was Carlton, Mellick who had founded that. And he had taken it over after, I think, John Edward Lawson, maybe. And then Bradley Sands was doing something called Bust Down the Door and Eat All the Chickens, which had, was publishing stories and poetry from all over the place. But there were a lot of the bizarre authors and stuff that were in there. So, and I had a couple things in that. So it was just, you know, kind of an organic meshing of things.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, you know, now the history of it all, you weren't necessarily ground floor Eraserhead, but certainly there in the very early days. And your work, like, I mean, Fuckness and Zero Strata are just, they often come up as like great examples of, you know, what bizarro fiction was early on. They're always identified that way, despite like where you say, you know, it wasn't even called bizarro then, but, you know, the history of it is. Books like that, they come out when I know when I first discovered bizarro, you know, one of those recommendations that was always there was Fuckness. And it's like, well, I'm constantly seeing this book cover, it must be bizarro, I must need, you know, to read this. But I mean, the truth of it is, for you at least, it's not necessarily what you were doing, but on the same token, you were there at the ground floor, so it almost categorizes itself that way. It's a weird a situation, I guess, to be in.
Right. And Fuckness was an interesting book to begin with, because that was one that it was actually the first like novel that I had written and completed and was happy with it. And this was like in the early 2000s. And I had been shopping it around, and it was called The Boy with Horns at the time. And then, once I had started Odolotl, it was like, it had interest, but, you know, never anybody to, you know, buy the book for another publisher or whatever. Mm. And then I think around that time, Joe Hill put out a book called Horns, and I was just kind of like, oh, fuck me. What am I going to do with this? So I changed the title so that it didn't even have horns in the title, I just changed it to Fuckness, which was a kind of recurring word in the book. And, you know, it's probably a sort of serendipitous thing that I did, because I think that a lot of the people who bought it, and it's to this day my best-selling book, and I think that a lot of people who bought it probably bought it because of the title. So anyway, and then I was going through my second divorce at the time, so I was kind of ready to just walk away from publishing and writing in general, just because I didn't have the money to publish anymore. And then, you know, I was just going to write stuff and send them out and hope that somebody published them. Mm-hmm. But I was ready to kind of fold it up. And it, I think, just kind of coincided with the whole sort of Kindle boom of around 2011, 2012. So it took off on digital and started doing really, really well. And then I put it in paperback solely because at the time, the printer had started doing matte covers. That was like a new thing at the time. And I just wanted to see what they looked like. So I turned it into a paperback. There was no author bio, no author photo, no anything. Like when it was on Kindle, it wasn't even listed under any publisher whatsoever. And, and I just actually started, you know, kind of making a fair amount of money off of writing for the first time ever, really. Mm-hmm. And, it kind of continued for a few years. And, it sort of bailed out Grindhouse and Adelotto and kind of sort of kept those running. So, and I did nothing to promote it whatsoever. I think it was just, there was this Kindle boom. I think maybe, you know, it got hooked up on the Amazon algorithm to, you know, better selling authors like, Chuck Palahniuk, and I know for a while it was closely associated with John Dies at the End. Mm-hmm. So like people who were buying those were buying it also just because, you know, it was cheap. They liked the title. Whatever. But it was definitely a very welcome boon.
Yeah. it helped out in other ways, but it was still like an honest work from you. It just happened to be the right thing sitting in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. And essentially published it just to get it off the hard drive because I was tired of, you know, I mean, I had been dicking with it for nearly a decade. And it was just, you know, how many times am I going to rewrite this? How many places? I mean, I have a stack of rejection letters, you know, some of them personalized and fairly complimentary, but, you know, I could not get anybody to take the bait. And, after a while, you just kind of like have to, and I'd always been working on other things too, but, mm-hmm. you know, eventually you just have to move forward. And for me with that one, it was, you know, I think it got enough of a positive response to where I didn't feel like it sucked completely, which I think anybody sort of self-publishing stuff has to kind of wrestle with, you know? Mm-hmm. I just decided to do that.
I've had an interesting experience with your work because, you know, despite having, you know, constantly seen the recommendations for like Fuckness, Eurostrata, I chose to open up first from you the driver's guide to hitting pedestrians. I kind of dug the title and the look and everything. And let me see. Yeah. Let me check out what this Anderson Prunty's all about that keeps getting recommended to me. And
yeah,
you have the dubious distinction of having one of the two, like, I hated the book. I'm sorry to say. I did not get it. Like, when I think there's two books that just stand out as like, I don't know what to do with this. And that is your hitting pedestrian book. And also, Bradley Sands, Sorry, I Ruined Your Orgy. I opened it up and I was just like, I don't know what this, I have no idea. And so I gave it a 1-star review. I kind of gave it's me, not you kind of a review, and just like, this just isn't for me. I don't understand it. But as a result, like, I just like, well, I don't like that Anderson Prunty guy stuff. Like, I get he's a respected writer in the community, and I'm sure there's people that stuff is able to connect with, but it's not me, unfortunately. And then, you know, fast forward a few years later, and I get to meet you, and we've seen each other for a few years now at Scares at Care, and this past year, at the Bizarre Reading Hour, you did a reading of a piece called, was it Office Party, I think, just simply titled?
Oh, yeah, Office Party.
Yeah, and I enjoyed the hell out of it. I'm like, well, that was absolutely nothing like The Driver's Guide to Hitting Pedestrians. So, it's
almost exactly like The Driver's Guide to Hitting Pedestrians, though.
Maybe, I don't know. I might have to go back and, like, open the book again. But it did cause me to go, well, well, all right, well, I dug that, so let me give it another shot. And what I did was, lo and behold, I said, let's give Failure as a Way of Life, a more recent release from you. And I read Failure as a Way of Life, and I loved the hell out of that book. And I'm like, well, this is a far better experience like that. And so to me, it was like, well, maybe there were, I don't know, maybe different phases of your writing where one was like maybe like some more experimental stuff that didn't jive with me. And now you're into more like a narrative, character driven type of stuff that I do connect with. Is that how it is? Is it my perception off? what is the difference between like a Failure as a Way of Life and back to the Driver's Guide to Hitting Pedestrians? Do they seem the same to you?
Well, I don't know. They wouldn't seem the same to me because I think, you know, the Driver's Guide is, there's a opening kind of long short story. Mm-hmm. And then most of the rest of it is sort of like, you know, 3 to 5 page stories or flash fictions or whatever. Yeah. But, definitely more, I think, idea driven and just sort of language driven, than character driven. But I mean, you're not going to get a character driven thing with a 5-page story.
Yeah.
Really? You know?
Yeah.
I think it's kind of whatever I'm in the mood for. And also, I don't put a tremendous amount of thought or planning into what I'm writing. I just kind of like, sort of let it, do what it needs to do. Mm-hmm. Something like Failure's Way of Life, I had, you know, that scope, and there's certain things I want to do with it. But obviously spent a lot more time on it than most of the content of something like the Driver's Guide. And they're for different, I think they're for different purposes too. You know, like I think things that are in the Driver's Guide and this may be why you liked Office Party, is that I think that stuff, when performed, comes out a lot better than, probably being read. But it's good to have things like that to read in front of people, because I don't typically like to read from novels.
Right.
Just because it's not a complete thing. Mm-hmm. And evolution wise, like I don't know. I mean, there's not a tremendous amount of time separating something like the Driver's Guide from Failure as a Way of Life. But I think it's just obviously something that's going to be perceived differently from person to person. And I think, it's like there are some people who love the Driver's Guide. It's definitely not one of my more well-reviewed things. And I mean, and to me, it just seems kind of messy. Like, I think that the things, the stories in it maybe don't go together that well. I'm not going to say that I'm never going to do anything like that again.
Right.
Well, if I do another collection of flash fictions, it will probably be very similar to the Driver's Guide.
Okay, I'll try.
You might want to avoid that one.
Well, yeah, give me a trigger warning or something. But to paraphrase what the protagonist in Failure as a Way of Life, sort of a failed writer himself, and he said something along the lines of, my stuff's all over the place and a lot of people don't get some of it. You know, he almost shared that sentiment of like my reaction to, you know, the two pieces of work.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that like you get like in your, because I'm not exposed to anything other than really those two pieces of work from you. So, you know, are your books, do they vary like a great deal from one to the other? Like they're really stand out from one to the other.
Well, I think that there's probably a sensibility that, that a lot of them have that sort of carries from one book to the next. I mean, I think that the people who really like my stuff are probably a fairly specific type of person. And I think for that type of person, I think they're probably going to like just about anything I do. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know, there's something like the Sorrow King, which is, you know, to me, you know, a fairly straightforward horror novel. And then, you know, there are, you know, some of the later books like Sociopaths in Love and This Town Needs a Monster that are, you know, sort of, you know, definitely horror heavy. But then, you know, there are also kind of, you know, bizarre occurrences, and they're probably told in such a way that, that the mainstream horror reader isn't really going to, enjoy. I think they're kind of all over the place, you know, thematically. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a sensibility and ultimately, you know, an essence to them that is, that, you know, you could carry from one book to the next. But, you know, look, like if you, you know, if you like Zero Strata, which is a sort of, you know, sweet, surreal kind of twee love story, then you're probably going to be made really, really uncomfortable by something like This Town Needs a Monster or Sociopaths in Love. I mean, they're, you know, you'll probably feel like you need a shower after reading those.
Well, maybe that's where I need to head now, because I don't think I've really read any of your more horror titles, and maybe that's more the distinction, as it's not, you know, sort of experimental versus more narrative. Maybe it's more literary versus horror type stories that maybe give you that duality. Maybe it is that Grindhouse versus Addle sides to you.
It could be. It's hard to say. I don't know. And I don't. I think that's the thing too. Like, once they're finished, it's just kind of like, you know, and with Carrie's books too at CB Hunt, you know, we will kind of kind of figure out which press it needs to go. And for her books too, we just kind of figure out which ones it mm-hmm. need, you know, which imprint we want them to go under based on, you know, the, yeah, kind of overall tone of it. I think I've published some experimental things under Adelaide. I wouldn't really describe anything that I've written, I think, as experimental, at least not in sort of, you know, form. I think that they're told in a fairly straightforward way.
Yeah.
Granted, the things that are happening are a bit, you know, surreal or off kilter, but I don't think they're written in such a way that, you know, that like an average non-academic person wouldn't be able to understand them. I mean, I'm not an academic person, so that's not who I'm writing for.
I'm sure I'm miscategorizing it by saying it's experimental. It's more like a surrealism or the weirdness of it. Kind of, if I can't wrap my head around it, then it's hard to take in. And sometimes it's just far too weird for me.
Totally understandable.
So now that you are balancing this writing along with maintaining the press, and like you said, you no longer take care of Grindhouse, that's Carrie now, CB Hunt, but you still have Addle. I mean, I imagine was it just the workload, you know, handing over Grindhouse to Carrie? Is it hard to juggle all that, or do you maintain a good balance between writing and the publishing work?
Maintain a balance, maybe not a good balance. I think that Carrie is doing a way better job with Grindhouse than I ever would have done. And, you know, and part of that is that, you know, when you, you can stretch yourself too thin. You know, I mean, we see writers stretching themselves too thin with, you know, wanting to, you know, do podcasts and, you know, write three books for three different presses and also have a YouTube channel and also have a day job and a family. You know, it's just like there's a certain point where you realize that you're stretched too thin and you need to kind of take a step back. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what happened there. It was like, you know, and on top of that too, it was like at the time I was recording my own audiobooks. I had recorded Ritualistic Human Sacrifice for Carrie. So it was like, you know, working, and I'm not like an audio engineer, so it's just figuring everything out from scratch. So it was like, you know, that stuff. Yeah, with life stuff too. You know, for me, I was just going to close down Grindhouse because I felt like Oddlottle would be less limiting going forward in the future. Like, we're not opposed to publishing dark stuff or horror stuff even, you know, and it just seemed to be more broadly interesting for me. And, you know, she didn't want to see Grindhouse go away, and obviously I didn't either. And, you know, and I just felt like she would do a really good job with it. So, she took it over, which gave the, at least dealing with submissions and the sort of, you know, just day to day of, dealing with those authors. I'd cut that workload in half, which was, liberating. And then, you know, like I said, still copy editing. So I'm opening Oddlottle to submissions, I think, in November. I think I will never not be incredibly busy. Mm-hmm. So, but it's, no, it did. It was, it did help split the workload and spend a little bit more time on my own writing. And ultimately, you know, it'll allow me to spend more time with Oddlottle and those writers too. So, that's a good thing.
So obviously Oddlottle just still being around and you wanting to, you know, choose one or the other, it must still be important for you to maintain Oddlottle at the very least as that outlet that you started it for, as like another place for your friends and for writers you're aware of to have a place to come to get their work out there. You know, to have that option always there, I guess, obviously.
Definitely.
There's got to be a reward in doing it all.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and that's, you have to, you know, I guess you have to kind of figure out what you want the reward to be. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I don't, I mean, if I were losing money hand over fist, I wouldn't be able to do it. You know, I would be bankrupt. I'm not really looking at making money off of it. That it literally is just kind of, finding a book that I'm passionate about, authors who I'm passionate about, and wanting to give them an outlet to at least, have a book to market and, you know, to try and get, you know, whatever they can out of that. And that's kind of the satisfaction. It's just like, you know, you've put something entertaining out in the world. Author's happy. I'm happy. You know, it's all good.
Yeah. Do you think if it ever did become a detriment to your writing, that you would give it up? Like, the writing still be more important to you than maintaining that press if one encroached on the other?
Well, I think that, you know, like I said, there are huge financial ups and downs. I'm not a rich guy. So it's kind of like when like Fuckness and a couple of my other books were sort of experiencing that Kindle boom and doing really, really well. Mm-hmm. I, you know, wasn't doing a lot of editing for, you know, Grindhouse or Oddlottle. It was, you know, trying to write the next thing to get it up on Kindle. And, at the time, like, it was where you could record your own audiobooks for Audible. So there was one year that I spent a big chunk of the year like recording and editing 17 of those, because, you know, because I'm going to make money off of those, more so than like reading submissions or something like that. So it's one of those things that, you know, you have to sort of realize, I think, when things are happening and, not that I wasn't doing anything with Ottolottle or Grindhouse, but it did slow down because I was trying to focus on that. And then, you know, flash forward a few years and like, you know, my personal sales start to cool a lot. And then, you know, and then I throw myself a little bit more into the presses because, you know, you begin to realize that people are not probably waiting on the next Anderson Prunty book. so you can work on something else. And also, you know, I mean, I get bored with things, so including myself. So it's like, you know, I'm not a sit down, write every day kind of guy. It's like, you know, once I finish a book and publish it, I'm probably going to need a 2-3 months away from my brain. And you know, in that time, that's when it's, you know, almost therapeutic to read other people's writing and to work on their books too, which is, you know, you can get into the intricacies of, you know, laying out formatting without, you know, wrestling with your own brain.
Yeah. That's a good thing. The good distraction to have, I guess, too, for that. And then the fact that you're able to take a break, you don't feel like the pressure to, you know, writer always writes, got to write every day thing, that you are able to step away for even months at a time. And you have that other thing to occupy yourself. That's good, because I think a lot of people do beat themselves up over when they're not able to write constantly and they think they need to. I think it's,
oh, and it's, yeah. And I definitely used to, I mean, I definitely used to be, you know, like, you, whatever happens, you're writing for 2 hours today. And looking back on it, I mean, there's stuff that I generated during that period of time that I was too embarrassed to even put my name on. And, you know, it's just like, I think me writing because I feel like I have to is not a good thing.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing too. Like I said, it's like, I've never done this, you know, professionally. It's never been my livelihood. I do take it very seriously, and especially, you know, what I'm doing for other people. I take them seriously, and I take their work seriously. But I just want to have fun, right, doing it. Even a lot of the, you know, sort of depressing, cynical shit I write, like, that's still somebody having a lot of fun making chaos.
You can tell that comes through that tone, that like you're not suicidal or anything like that. There is a sort of a diabolicalness to almost presenting the people like that.
Yeah, that's good. There's a lot of tongue in cheek. There's a lot of tongue in cheek happening in those. Like, you know, like, and I think there's some of them that I'm surprised that people have taken as seriously as they do, because it's sort of like with something like Fuckness, it was almost like so depressing that it has to be funny. Mm-hmm. Nobody really finds it funny. Some do, but
even failure as a way of life. I know.
Sure. Okay. So when I started that, Carrie and I had just bought a house in a sort of depressing neighborhood, following living in a town where we really, really liked to live. It was just kind of like lease was up, you know, started, I don't know, getting that middle age thing of like, I gotta buy a house. And so we did this, made a horrible mistake. And Failure's a Way of Life was what I had started writing when I first moved there. And I literally had to just shelve it and put it aside, because it was like, living here is so fucking depressing that, like, if I'm also coming home and like writing this thing every day, then I literally am going to be suicidal, you know? So it was just like, yeah, just put it aside, because it hit a little too close to home. And then, yeah, it wasn't until we were pretty sure that we were going to be selling the place and moving out of there that I finally finished it. And, you know, and it actually felt very therapeutic, because I knew that I would be leaving that area, not stuck there for the next 30 years, which.
Yeah, it toys with your reading, because you read that character. You're like, how much more can this guy take? How much more bad stuff does he have to go through? And you could almost feel, though, like that you playing with the reader, like, you know, I'm tugging at you, I'm tugging at your thing. And there is a sort of fun thing. Like, you could almost feel you having fun with the readers writing this character, going through this just endless, like, how much worse can it get? how much more can he screw up himself and just accept his lot in life?
Right. So there needs to be a part two, because where can you even go?
Now that would totally be fun if you did that. Yeah. So I, it is that sort of thing where, you know, you can read it and it just beats up your psyche to read somebody like that. But at the same time, there is this kind of, you can feel you, Anderson, toying with the reader by constantly playing like that.
Well, that's good. I'm glad that you got that out of it. I mean, and it's not even so much toying with the reader. It's just keeping myself engaged, you know, like, yeah. I've never been a huge fan of sort of just the three act structure, because I kind of feel like when I encounter those things, I'm kind of like, the first act is what has my interest. You know, mm-hmm. it's when new characters are being introduced, you know, there's some situation. And then I almost feel like the next two, for a lot of things, I mean, obviously there are some people who do it exceptionally well. But then I always just feel like that's a kind of like connecting the dots or sort of painting by numbers sort of thing. Like, you know, you can almost, you know, you finish the first third of a book and you're almost just kind of like, okay, well, I think I almost know how this is going to turn out now. And I like things that keep you guessing or just downward spiraling is fine too.
It's another thing you bringing up, like, your living situation at the time around writing that book and everything. And I've noticed too, just following you on social media and the way your releases go, it seems like a lot of your life situations or things you observe around you easily leak into your fiction. Is that where you draw a lot of ideas from, just what's going on in the world around you that you just see out there on the street every day?
Yeah, I would say probably the world around. There's very little actual, you know, personal or biographical things in any of my books or even me online. Like, I just don't really talk about a lot of that stuff a lot. So, yeah, it's more probably what's happening around me, how I'm engaging with the world around me and just, you know, running those through some sort of filter. And then I think that there's probably, you know, whatever kind of emotional landscape I'm dealing with at the time, I think that's kind of in there too. And then it's just probably kind of a marriage of those things of, you know, what, not really an axe to grind, just, you know, just whatever sort of issues you're thinking about, both, yeah, world issues and emotional issues. So I mean, it's not completely abstract, but you know, you do kind of have to walk through the world with your eyes and ears open. And I think that probably informs just about any creative person's output.
Yeah, for sure. But I kind of I'm looking at it through, like, you have those breaks between, you know, books that you write. Are you constantly in those breaks? Are you thinking about what the next project can be, should be, or is it you're not thinking at all? And then, say, 3 months down the line, all of a sudden, bang, this idea pops in my head. This is what I need to write. How do you formulate the ideas for the next book?
Well, like I said, I don't really force myself to write. So it is just kind of I think anybody who writes or does anything creative is, you know, they probably just have sort of a head full of ideas kind of all the time. I mean, you know, we're just trying to amuse ourselves. And it's, you know, but there's a lot of sort of competing voices in there, and not to sound like, you know, schizophrenic or anything. But, you know, and then I think there are always the sort of ones that are kind of the sort of, you know, the loudest person in the room. And that's usually what will get my attention when I actually sit down to start writing something, because that's going to be what's going to keep me most engaged for, you know, the duration of the book or story or whatever.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, like you said, that's kind of how it always goes for them, whether they're constantly writing or not. It's just the creative mind works that way, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I'm not an outliner, and yeah. I don't. I'm not writing down a bunch of ideas and thinking, you know, well, like which one's what. It's just whatever I'm going to be able to engage.
Yeah.
The most with.
Right. So is it just a feel like I'm ready to get back to writing now? I got the itch, the bug, the idea now, and now it's time to sit down and just, you know, like the seat of your pants, pantsing it and writing out that story. That's how it begins.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and some of them are, you know, some of them take a while, and I have to give them a number of passes, you know, and the pretty heavy editing, and then other ones are just kind of, you know, happen really fast, like Neon Dies at Dawn, which is the last thing I published. It kind of took me a while to get rolling with it, but once I did, it happened really fast. There wasn't a ton of editing to be done, not a lot that needed added or taken out or anything like that. You know, but then something like Fuckness, you know, took me, you know, well over a year to write. So again, it's really just the book. Like, if I don't think something needs to be worked to death, then I'm not going to work it to death. And we don't know, you know, like, especially when you're not, you know, I'm not really dealing with an editor to accept stuff. Mm-hmm. It's literally just kind of direct from me to the readers, and from past experience, it's sometimes that works out really, really well. And sometimes you can basically at the end of the day say, I probably didn't even need to write that book. like the response is so lackluster that if I had just not written it, I think the world would have been okay. You know, and you deal with that too. So it's, you know, I think anything writing wise, you have to be totally prepared for the highs and the lows, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, because you publish that way and write, is how you're writing and publishing a very linear thing? Like, okay, I'm sitting down, I'm writing this thing, it's done in whatever, 6 months, a year, now it gets released, then I write, the next one. Is it just, I write it, it gets edited, polished up, and gets released, or will you hold things back if you don't really feel they're the right thing?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I have stuff that is just completely unpublished that I'm not happy with. There's stuff that I've put out under other names just to see, you know, if they get any reaction, mm-hmm. Whatsoever. And there's the process for me anymore is kind of like, so it's like, try to write this thing. Oh, wait, I have these 12 books that I have to copy edit, so that's probably going to take me a couple months, so I could start looking at writing this thing and maybe a couple months down the road, or squeezing it in whenever I can, or doing that. And then it's like, okay, well, now I'm going to open to submissions, and so let me read through those. And it's, you're a family person. You have like a wife and children and stuff. Mm-hmm. You probably oftentimes feel like you have absolutely zero control over your life. Right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, I was a young parent also, and a disastrous first marriage. Mm-hmm. So I in my 20s, I kind of established that I don't really have much of a control on my surroundings or anything like that. So, you know, once you can embrace chaos and unpredictability and, complete disasters, you know, you just try and make the best of it, you know, mm-hmm. turn it into a beautiful dumpster fire as opposed to just a smelly dumpster fire. So I think if I were to try and go at anything linearly, I think my head would just explode.
Yeah.
Because it would just be, you know, trying to force something down a path that it just doesn't want to go down. And I don't. The word linear is probably hardly in my vocabulary.
Fair enough. Do you at least shoot for, say, like at least one release a year from yourself, or even that's not any kind of priority for you?
No, I do. I mean, ideally, yeah, definitely. I do try for that, but, you know, and then it kind of makes it almost, you know, cause when you do that, cause you, I think, you know, you do need a bit of a fire under your ass to, mm-hmm. to do hardly anything. But I think, and that gives it, you know, sort of like an end of the year perspective when you're like, well, this year I managed to release 110 page book. So I was probably really busy doing a bunch of other stuff. And then sure enough, when you look up at the shelf and find out, you know, what else you've done, it's, you're like, okay, so no, I was very busy. I was very busy this year.
Right.
But yeah, definitely a book a year is a goal. I mean, I do have, there's, I think 1 year that I didn't release a book, but, yeah, it's a comfortable goal, but it's not, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to get ill if that doesn't happen.
You're the chillest dude in publishing. Everything just like water off a duck's back. Don't bother. Which is a great way to be, for sure, because then nothing can frazzle you, really. You don't allow it to.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I mean, at the end of the day, this is about, it's about entertainment and ideas and, you know, if you're the type of people who, you know, are online a lot or go to conventions or something like that, then it can also become about interconnectedness and just reaching out to, or, you know, communicating with other people. And, you know, which are all kind of positive things, I think. So I think that's how more of us should probably look at it. It's not a competition. It's not a, you know, it's not, you're probably not going to be making a living off of it. You know, some people do get lucky, but, you know, so, yeah.
Yeah, you have to, like you said, it's, you have to pick and choose what your rewards are, what your idea of successes are, and maybe don't shoot too high on those things. Like you said, don't expect.
Oh, no, definitely manage your expectations.
Yeah. Wonderful way to put it too. And then you can't be disappointed then if you aim low. But you're so right. Like the level of seriousness a lot of people take to this and get all wound up about things that really in the end are trivial is just not worth it. And everything would be so much better if we could all calm down perhaps and put some perspective on things before we get wound up. And the whole the community, the industry would be a lot easier to deal with.
Right. And I hesitate by saying that too, that it maybe hints at some level of sloppiness or whatever. And you know, that is something that I think, you know, you should take your craft very seriously. You know, it's just if things don't work out the way you want them to, it's not the end of the world, but, you know, yeah, but before writing that story or book, you should probably kind of pay attention to how, mm-hmm. how books and stories are written. learn the basics of grammar and mm-hmm. that kind of thing, because, you know, but again, too, that doesn't matter to a lot of people. And, you know, if you just want to have books out with your friends and whatever, and celebrate that fact, then, you know, more power to you.
Right. It's an artistic choice in a lot of ways. I guess as long as you're conscious of those things being an artistic choice and, like you said, not being sloppy, not being lazy about things. I don't think at this point anybody would ever accuse you of being lazy or sloppy about how your own writing or how you conduct your own press. You've more than demonstrated your level of professionalism and commitment to all that stuff, for sure. So you would never get accused of that at all.
Well, thank you. That feels that feels good.
Now, before we do wrap up, I did not know this that you brought it up before, that you were recording your own audiobooks. I am floored by that, because while I have never done it myself, I can only begin to imagine the torture that you might have put yourself through. Attempting to do, what did you say, 17 books in a year?
Audio? Well, I think that's what it is. I think that's what it was. And then, you know, once you put these out, you know, you kind of realize that, I mean, I just do things like that because I'm a cheapskate, mm-hmm. and I don't want to pay anybody else to do it. And, well, but now I do pay other people to do it because, you know, eventually you realize that maybe you're not the best person for the job.
Yeah.
A lot of people, I think, tend to think that I sound like a bored robot, very monotone. And again, too, part of it was because using shitty equipment, you know, it's like I just basically, you know, had to keep things at a very level.
Yeah.
And plus, you know, I'm not an actor or anything like that. Like I have, you know, no idea. So anyway, yeah, it was very exhausting. But in the end, I realized that I'm not the best person for the job and I don't do it anymore, but, and it's incredibly time consuming.
Yeah.
So
I know audiobooks themselves are, you know, hours, 8, 10, 12 plus hours, the cleaned up, edited, ready to go version, but the amount of time spent, you know, getting it there could be double, even triple that. Were you putting in like insane amount of hours on that stuff?
Yeah, I figured that, well, I would, I don't think I was doing any writing at the time. So I would come home from my day job, take my nap or whatever, cause I'm a child. and get up and yeah, head into another room and just record myself for at least a couple hours. And then you would have to edit that. And I think I told Carrie that I figured for every minute of finished audio, it was taking me 10 minutes to edit that down. So, you know, so it's like every hour, you know, that you're putting into it is like 6 hours of labor. That's probably faulty math, but something like that. Extreme time suck, definitely. Yeah.
And I know just doing this podcast, sometimes when I'm doing several interviews in the day, like, you don't think about it, but you start punishing your voice and you're like, I have to stop talking. And I imagine the experience too. Like when you say you sit there sometimes 4 or 6 hours, at some point doing that, your voice must have been suffering for it too.
And also because, like, I mean, I, you know, have a day job that I'm fairly nonverbal throughout that. So like, I'm not talking all day. You know, yeah, I don't have like a robust voice anyway for, you know, even, you know, so yeah, to just talk for 2 hours at a time or whatever, it's, the voice does start to go, and to do that day in and day out. Yeah, that was probably challenging as well. But, you know, it was a good learning experience. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Do any of those books still exist out there on Audible? You know, the work.
Oh yeah, they're all out there. They're all out there on Audible. Like I said, I think, yeah, I did a lot of them, and there are a few done by somebody else. There's a guy named E.B. Adams that did the audio for Neon Dies at Dawn, and I think he just did an amazing job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something you when you hear somebody do it well, you realize, you know, that makes all the difference in the world. You know, at least from trying to sell the things.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm not big into audiobooks, but as I understand it, you know, as people, you know, will follow their favorite authors, people who are into audiobooks will follow their favorite, you know, readers, narrators, audio or voice talents in the same way.
Well, I think they did too, and I think that's one of the reasons that I wanted to record my own to begin with too, because it was like, you know, I always enjoyed, I'm a big audiobook now, a big audiobook listener now, but I haven't always been. But I've always kind of preferred the author reading, mm-hmm. you know, reading their own work, even if they're clearly not, you know, a professional, actor. So yeah, that's what I wanted to do. I just, you know, yeah, I just think in the end it became too tedious, I have noticed people, yeah, following specific narrators too, which makes sense. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, for sure.
It's like, you know, being a fan of an actor, I guess.
Yeah. It's gotta be the same thing. Yeah. I always like those when somebody's able to do different sort of voices and make them all stand out. It doesn't sound like the same person doing the just different inflections, and they become distinct characters. That's what I enjoy, you know, out of an audiobook. For as little as I listen to them, and I think it's because I listen to it like I would listen to a radio program. I'm not fully engaged in them, and therefore I lose a lot in the translation. But when the voice actor is doing that job where, you know, all the characters have distinct voices, different from one another, really grabs me, and I pay a lot more attention to them.
No, it's a feat for an audio book narrator to be able to keep you engaged, because I'm like you too. Like that was one of the reasons that I was hesitant to get into them, because I found myself phasing out so much, you know. But then I had to stop and realize it's like, you know, there are times that I pick up like a paperback and I'm tired or just not into it or whatever, and it'll be like, you know, 15 minutes later and I'm like, I have no idea what the fuck I just read. I could not tell you a single thing that I've read in the last like 15 minutes, you know. So I'm like, no, that's audiobooks are really no different than that, you know. Like you'll phase out, but if, you know, if you're engaged with a narrator, if you're engaged with the book itself, you know, it will hold your attention, you know. So at the end of the day, it's like I don't really struggle to even remain engaged with it. It's just kind of like, it's 6 hours later, the book has ended. If I remember it, you know, then I must have found it compelling. If I have no idea what I just listened to, then it's probably not for me.
there's some truth to that. Yeah, I could understand that. Do you think for you, since you do have that preference for the author reading, if you were able, if you had the benefit of say, all you had to do is show up and be the talent, be the voice, and then go home, and everybody else would take care of the more technical aspects of it, thus freeing up a great deal of time, that you would do it again?
Probably, yeah, probably. Yeah. If I didn't have to do everything else, I probably would. Yeah. Just because I think, you know, I mean, you know, I think I probably improved a little bit, you know, while I was doing it. Mm-hmm. And it might depend on the book too, you know. Like there would be, you know, like I had another narrator do Failure as a Way of Life, which, you know, I would, I had already decided that I wasn't going to do it anymore, but like that's one of those that I would have loved to have been able to do myself, because you know, I just feel like that character's voice is probably very similar to my own. You know, but then there's something like Neon Dies at Dawn, where, you know, the character is the protagonist is an older retired man. It's written in first person. So I'm like, yeah, I probably wouldn't be right for that, you know, to begin with. And then, you know, yeah, so I think it would depend on the book, but there are, you know, yeah, some that I would definitely want to do myself, just because, you know, they're very close to my voice.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if it was because of the proximity of hearing you do that reading that scares that care, but I definitely felt hearing you read that and understanding your voice, your pacing, that I think in my head I read the book the same way, the same sort of pacing, the same sort of tone as you had read, like, Office Party, and it seemed like the correct fit in my head the way I heard it.
Oh, yeah, I could see that. No, I mean, and then that's the thing where I think, you know, writing wise, stylistically, you know, I think there's definitely a sense of sort of playful chaos with both of those things, even though they're, you know, kind of very far apart on, you know, the one is probably a lot more absurd than the other one. Maybe. I don't know. I guess they're both kind of absurd, right?
It's true. Now, I guess the million-dollar question here, as we sort of head towards wrapping up, is the audiobook version of the guide to hitting pedestrians available? Maybe I could appreciate it more if I heard you read it tonight.
Oh, it is, and oh, I am reading it.
Oh,
so let me send you a code to that one, Frank, just so you can spend another couple hours with that book.
Yes.
And with my sweet, sweet voice in your ear.
Maybe that's what I need in the end. Is for you to read it.
You just need my voice like honey to help that pill. Yes. Help that pill go down.
The other man with a golden voice. Anderson Prundy, it has been a treat to finally get to talk to you here on Bazong and share you with the world. I'm glad you were able to take the time to do this with us. I would love it if somewhere down the line again, you'd be willing to rejoin us.
Sure, yeah, and thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Zongers, Anderson Prunty. I still can't believe I scored that interview. For me, a definite highlight in the history of Bazong right there was made. Zongers, a little behind the scenes on that. I first met Anderson, probably going back 4 years ago at Scares That Care when they showed up for the first time. Maybe it's 3 years ago or whatnot. That's when I first invited him onto Bazong, and he was, you know, just not my thing. I don't like doing interviews. Cool, no problem. But over these past several years, always stop and talk to Anderson, have a good time, always talking to him. I actually did moderated a panel where he was on it too, so it was like my little secret chance to get to interview him there as well. But at this past Scares, he was just kind of like, I guess we got comfortable with one another, and he said, all right, you know, I know you good and everything, and you know, if you want, reach out to me, and we'll do this interview. So that's how it was made. I had to work him over for 3 years to get you that interview. That's the perseverance that Mr. Frank brings you here on Bazong each and every week. That's the payoff for doing this show for like 3.5, almost 4 years now, Zongers. That is what we get. We finally get an Anderson Prunty caliber guest on the show. And like I said, I was a little nervous myself interviewing. I didn't want to screw this one up. There it is. I hope you all enjoyed it, and I hope he will in the future be able to sit down and talk to us maybe about something new he has coming out, and we can be a little more focused on one work in particular instead of going over his whole career, he's just been in the game for so long. There's so much to cover, and I feel like we just scraped the iceberg with Anderson. He's just a really, really cool dude. And knows his stuff. Now he's a great writer, a great publisher, and he's an asset to this community for sure. And another asset to this community, hopefully in the near future, is going to be Chandler Morrison's new book, Until the Sun, from Death's Head Press, available right now for pre-order, releasing on the holiest of days, Halloween. Until the Sun is not your grandma's vampire novel. Responsibility, authority, morality. If you could liberate yourself of these burdens, would any cost be too great? Available in Kindle and paperback on Amazon on the holiest of days, Halloween, from Death's Head Press and Chandler Morrison. Halloween is rapidly approaching, Zongers. And you know what else is rapidly approaching, Zongers? The end of this week's episode. We've gone a little long, but no big deal. And don't forget, Zongers, help out Bazong and the Project Entertainment Network by going and supporting their Patreon page. That's patreon.com. Search for Project Entertainment Network. And there, for as little as $1 a month, you will get lots of value-added content, including content from Mr. Frank. And, of course, Zongers, Bazong is always available for advertising. Your product, yourself, and your wares. So reach out to the Project Entertainment Network's webpage, where you can find out more information about advertising on Bazong and any of the other podcasts on the Project Entertainment Network. And speaking of podcasts on the Project Entertainment Network, you're now free to go and listen to these other great Project Entertainment Network podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, Project Entertainment Network presents The Mondo Method.
An old man with a goatee teaches a younger guy with a beard how to write.
Introducing first, he's the mentor and the greatest manager of all time, Mondo Guerrero. And from parts unknown, up-and-coming superstar, the Great Buddha.
Okay, so maybe their names are really just Armand Rosamilia and Chuck Buddha, and maybe you'll learn something while they're at it. Wednesdays exclusively on Project Entertainment Network.
The Unsupervised Podcast, a show about acceptance and diversity.
I guarantee you these are all white children.
You gotta shoot your shot, man.
Oh, Mick, do you want some rhinoceros?
A show about love.
It's called like a chicken McGangbang. It's like a...
Whoa, I'm the chicken McGangbang.
I'm always grumpy, so I want to dominate it.
I'm not part of the Pound Me Too movement.
With some high-class humor and some science.
You need to move your lips more.
Give me another rim job.
The popcorn gives you a boner? I don't get this.
It's science, okay?
Okay, maybe more like the Seinfeld of podcasts. Not really about anything specific, but we're going to make you laugh and entertain you for a little while. So tune in every Thursday exclusively on Project Entertainment Network.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.